This is 2RPH. I'm Jolyon Warwick-James, and you're listening to the Antiques Radio Show, bringing you a monthly kaleidoscope of things old, beautiful, or both, whether valuable or not. And on the Antiques Radio Show today, we have a biscuit and a couple of vases, which raises the question, where is it best to buy? And where is it safe to buy? We discover where, for about $1 million, you can keep your tennis balls. And there's a bit more, and we expose some old rackets. We find out a little bit more about what happened to Lady Chatterley's lover. That's the book, of course. And we suggest a splendid place to visit. But first of all, the biscuit. And this piece comes from the Antique Trade Gazette of the 11th of May. And the title, Lusitania Lifeboat Biscuit, takes £4,000. A hardtack biscuit purportedly taken from a lifeboat during the sinking of RMS Lusitania sold for £4,000 at Henry Aldridge and Sons' latest Titanic, White Star and Transport memorabilia sale on April the 27th. It attracts a 20% buyer's premium. The ocean liner Lusitania, briefly known as the world's largest passenger ship, was sunk on May 1915. The 104-year-old biscuit was bought by a private collector from Europe. The £300,000 sale was the first for new entity Henry Aldridge & Son Limited. Andrew Aldridge relaunched the business following the retirement of his father Alan in March. And there's a picture of the biscuit above the article. Now that biscuit cost altogether something in the vicinity with buyer's premium of $8,500. Thank you, Antique Trade Gazette. And now for something slightly less crackers, but also in the Antique Trade Gazette, but this time of the 25th of May. It's amazing what get given to charity shops, and it may not all end up on their shelves. And here's a story about Moorcroft pottery, that very collectible and rather nicely decorated pottery that often turns up. This piece was written by Roland Arkell and is entitled Moorcroft Charity Shop Donation Delivers £9,000. The recent art and design sale at Cheffins in Cambridge included these two 1930s Moorcroft tube-lined vases decorated with fish, a pattern from the later years of the William Moorcroft era. At 12 inches, that's 30 centimetres high, with full painted and impressed marks, both are rarities, but more remarkably was the story of the consignment. They'd been brought into the Salvation Army charity shop on Tennyson Road, Cambridge, in Tesco carrier bags. The anonymous donor, who was clearing the house of a relative, told staff members she was aware they were of some value, but was keen for them to be sold to benefit the charity. After some online research and advice from a local dealer, the vases were taken to Cheffins for a full appraisal. Shop manager Charmaine Wilson, who told the Antique Trade Gazette this was the most valuable offering the charity had received in her nine-year tenure, attended an auction for the first time to watch the vases sell on May the 9th. One, in a more typical matte glazed and pastel tones, sold for £4,000. The following lot, in a more desirable flambé glaze, took £5,000, against the same estimate of £1,500 to £2,500. Both in good condition, save a small glaze chip to the foot rim of the latter, sold to the same buyer. The charity shop has put a note of thanks in the window, should the generous donor pass by again. And this article comes with a picture of both vases decorated with fish. I think it's rather a nice and very generous story. But our next item is a story about a less charitable source of collecting items, and it comes from the art newspaper of June 2019, page 7. And it comes from a section called Global Briefing, and this is a section compiled by Christina Ruith. And it's titled, Looted Antiquities on Facebook. an investigation by the BBC revealed that Facebook is being used by networks of traffickers to buy and sell antiquities looted across the Middle East. The artefacts on offer include Roman mosaics still in the ground outside of Aleppo, Syria, and antiquities looted from the site such as Palmyra, also in Syria, which was devastated by Islamic State militants. Amr al-Azam, a Syrian archaeologist and a professor of Shawnee State University in Ohio, has trawled through hundreds of Facebook groups, many of which are private, as part of his opening Attar project. People use the Facebook groups, for example, to share information on how to build mechanisms that help in illegal excavations. And there are also loot-to-order requests, he told the BBC. He sent the Art newspaper a screenshot of a Facebook page which shows a user requesting the looting of books in Jordan. In response to the BBC investigation, Facebook said it had removed 49 groups from its platform. But al-Azam said that many of the groups he monitors are still active. He also noted that shutting down groups is the last thing Facebook should be doing, as he believes this would destroy invaluable evidence of the looting. And that, unlike our Moorcroft vases, is actually rather a sad story. And on a brighter note, anyone for tennis? This piece comes from the front page of the Antique Trade Gazette of the 22nd of June, and it comes with a picture of a large bowl, which is described as a censer. This is written by Roland Arkell, and the title is, "It was used to hold tennis balls, then it sold for £3.3 million. Incidentally, that's nearly $6 million Australian dollars. A Chinese parcel gilt bronze censer that was being used to hold tennis balls when first seen by valuers last year has sold at auction in Switzerland for close to £3.3 million. The Imperial Phoenix and Peony vessel, a fraction short of 2 feet, that's 60 centimetres, across and weighing over 22 kilograms, had caused a sensation when it was exhibited at this year's International Antiques Fair in Hong Kong, which ran from May 25th to 28th, in advance of its sale at Koller in Zurich on June the 4th. Estimated at 50 to 80,000 Swiss francs, it sparked intense phone and room bidding before it was secured by a Chinese collector for 4.2 million Swiss francs, which is £3.3 million, including buyer's premium. The quality, dimensions and design of the censer were deemed exceptional. Together, the phoenix heads and peony symbolise wealth and good fortune, while a use of the phoenix as the emblem of the Chinese empress suggests it was likely made for the imperial court. Although it carries a six-character mark for the fifth Ming Emperor Xuande, 1425 to 1435, it was thought to date from the early years of the Qing dynasty, circa 1700. It had been in a Swiss collection by descent from German ancestors for more than a century. The price is a house record, bettering the 3.2 million Swiss francs for a Sino-Tibetan bronze of the Buddhist deities Pandarakasha, sold in 2017. Now, those balls were probably of the type used on a grass, clay or hard court, as used today. And you may be familiar with the older royal or real tennis, which was a slightly different game where you could roll balls down a sloping roof and there was a saggy net in the middle. And there are 43 of those courts in the world, apparently, three in Australia, Melbourne, Ballarat and Hobart. But I wonder how many of you have heard of another game called rackets. This game was played in a court that resembled a squash court, but very much elongated and higher, and was played with a hard ball that travelled at extraordinarily high speeds, and one used a racket which had a very elongated handle. Looking at the names of past world champions, I noticed from 1937 to 1947, there was David S. Milford. And it caught my eye because I realised he had attempted valiantly to teach me geography at school. And I wonder if there are any rackets courts in Australia. If any listeners know of any, perhaps they'd like to ring in and let me know. I've still got my racket a bit warped and probably not workable, but it'd be very interesting to know if there are any courts. And this item comes from the Antique Trade Gazette of the 1st of June and comes with a picture of two rackets. The caption is that they were owned by prize-winning player George Langton Hodgkinson, and they are priced at £12,000 at the Manfred Schotten and Christopher Clark Antique Show. The title is Make a Racket Purchase in a Magical Selection of Antiques. Two rackets, no, you aren't seeing double, are on offer at the exhibition #7, It's a Magic Number, organised by Cotswold dealers Manfred Schotten and Christopher Clark Antiques. They were once owned by George Langton Hodgkinson, prize-winning player of the game of rackets. One is the Oxford University prize racket, which the Pembroke College student won in 1857. It's highly decorated with silver braided wirework to the top of the blue crushed velvet grip and an engraved butt cap. Hodgkinson was awarded it as winner of the Oxford Senior Doubles Rackets with William Hard Dyke. He later attributed the victory mainly to his partner. The second racket is the personal one that probably used to win the junior and senior doubles in 1857. It shows signs of use and the handle's engraved with his name, handwritten in ink. Offered for £12,000, the rackets are part of the biennial show staged by campaign furniture specialist Clark and sporting antiques dealer Schotten. The seventh edition runs from June the 1st to the 15th and presents the rare, unusual and magical items in their stock. Highlights include a chair from the RMS Olympic, a miniature walnut games table and a snooker table. A continued feature of these exhibitions is a navigational rally, June the 16th, held for owners of vintage and classic cars, as well as those with more modern vehicles. The event is held to benefit the local charity, Kate's Nursing Home, for which £40,000 has been raised during the past years. And we hope they had great success, and I wonder if those rackets sold. It'd be very interesting to know. You're listening to the Antiques Radio Show with Jolly and Warwick James on the 2RPH network. My, how things change. Standards, values and everything. Now, in an earlier programme, we featured the book Lady Chatterley's Lover, and I'd like to give you a little bit of an update on the book. And we go to the Antique Trade Gazette of the 25th of May, and the title is Lady Chatterley's Lover Fundraising Appeal, and there's a picture of the book. Writers Association English Pen has launched a GoFundMe page to raise the £56,250 needed to buy the copy of Lady Chatterley's Lover used by the judge in the infamous obscenity trial that has been barred from export by the government. The annotated copy once belonged to Sir Lawrence Byrne, who presided over the 1960 case. It is now regarded as a defining moment in British social history, marking the move towards a more liberal and permissive society. This copy of the book was sold at auction of the collection of Stanley J. Seeger at Sotheby's in October 2018 for a hammer price of £45,000. The government is asking for a buyer to match the £56,250 asking price, that's the hammer price plus fees, to keep it in the UK. The decision on the export licence application for the book will be deferred until August the 9th, which could be extended until October the 9th. Now that article prompted a letter to the Antique Trade Gazette, which was published on the 1st of June. And it was written by Neville Smith of London, writing to the editor. and the heading, "The Defence Loved This Prosecutor." "Madam, it was counsel for the Crown, Mervyn Griffith Jones, and not the Lady Chatterley's lover trial judge, Sir Lawrence Byrne, in Regina versus Penguin Books Limited, November 1960, who asked the jury in his opening remarks, 'Is it a book that you would wish your wife or your servant to read?' I remember it well. The defence must have been hugging themselves. The prosecutor had shown himself to be the ace up their sleeve. But Griffith Jones had previous in this regard. At an earlier trial of another novel, he had asked whether members of the jury would give the offending book as a Christmas present to the girls in the office, and if not, why not?" And I do actually wonder what girls in the office would say these days if they were given a copy of Lady Chatterley's Lover. So where does salaciousness begin and end? And where does pornography fit into all of this? Things certainly change. And we can have a look at that in the Art newspaper of May, where we have an item entitled "Danish Show Explores the Art of Porn." Comes from Copenhagen. In 1990, Dennis Barry, the Cincinnati Art Center director, was indicted under local obscenity laws for showing photographs by Robert Mapplethorpe in what became a key moment in the US's cultural wars. The incident had echoes of an earlier, less well-known trial in Denmark in 1937, when surrealist Wilhelm Freddy was prosecuted for making pornographic paintings. Freddy was to become a cause célèbre and was cited in the debates that led, in 1969, to a government act that legalised visual pornography in Denmark. Freddy's sculpture, Sex Paralyse Appeal, 1936, opens Art and Porn, an exhibition of 40 contemporary artists whose works critique and sometimes celebrate explicit sexual imagery. Work by 70s US feminists such as Betty Tompkins and Carolee Schneerman will be shown alongside pieces by young Scandinavians such as Anna Udenberg, whose work questions gender stereotypes. Works by Jeff Burton, Tom, of Finland, and William E. Jones explore queer identities, while Linda Sterling, Jesper Fabricius, and Mike Boucher focus on the circulation of porn. Boucher's untitled video, 2011, a mosaic of 10,000 films downloaded from the internet, is one of a number of large installations, including Amelia Ullman's Dignity, 2017, and a new work by Elm Green and Dragset. In Denmark, the 1969 Act was a momentous occasion. It symbolises the moment when a conservative nation became a more liberal, open society, says Rasmus Stenbakken, one of the show's creators, although he warns that the political tide is turning. Back in 1990, Barry was cleared. Nevertheless, exhibitions that include sexual imagery can still prove controversial. For example, in 2009, police in London obliged the Tate to take down Richard Prince's 1983 Spiritual America. "Art history is full of difficult, awkward, hostile pictures," notes Rune Gard, a Danish art historian who has written Art and Porn's introductory essay. "Images can offend, but the spaces provided by the realm of art are suited and have a duty to create safe settings for reflection and discussion." The exhibition is partly funded by the Danish Arts Foundation. And that was written in the Art newspaper by Jane Morris. And I guess it raises the question, where do we stand in Australia on art and porn? Well, whatever needs to come out or go back into the cupboard or closet, here is a good luck story, and it comes from the Antique Trade Gazette of the 18th of May, and it's entitled "Nolan Found in a Cupboard." A monogram and faint signature to a botanical study sold at Derbyshire saleroom Hanson's, which attracts a 20% buyer's premium, revealed it to be the work of celebrated Australian artist Sidney Nolan, 1917 to 1992. The 2 foot 6 inch by 2 foot 1 inch, that's 76 by 63 centimetres, oil on board, signed twice and dated to 1955, was included in the large five-day fine art sale on April the 3rd to the 6th and 11th, which was held at the Grade 2 listed interior of Bishop Hall in the rural Staffordshire. The picture formed part of a collection of 20th century art consigned from a Leicestershire academic institution that the sale room has been selling throughout the year. Adrian Rathburn, associate director at Hansen's, said he found the picture languishing in a cupboard and it depicted an unidentified, rather frazzled botanical study. Tentatively estimated at £2,000 to £3,000, it sold to a London buyer for £8,000. Nolan painted a number of flower studies during the 1940s and 50s, but these have been overshadowed by his more famous works from the period, notably his outback scenes on the theme of the 19th century bushranger Ned Kelly. Whatever may come out of a cupboard or a closet, what comes out of a box? And here's an article from the Sun Herald from the 7th of July on page 8, written by Patrick Begley, Box of Human Bones Pulled from Auction. A box of human bones, once in the possession of a worldly gentleman, was up for sale. Sydney auction house Lawson's advertised the set, part of a deceased estate, with a price estimated at $100 to $150 and no other details online. In the picture on Lawson's website, two long limb bones poked up above a jumble of others in the bottom of a brown box. A couple of anatomy guides were thrown into the bargain. But before lot 37-4A, or that maybe that's 374A, advertised as Box of Human Bones with Anatomy Guides, could go under the hammer on Thursday, questions about the bones led Lawson's to pull them from the sale. It's absolutely illegal, Fiona Gill, a senior lecturer in sociology at the University of Sydney, said of the sale of human bones. The Human Tissue Act, 1983, is really clear that it's not okay. On Wednesday, the day before the auction, the Sun Herald contacted Lawson's general manager, Simon Hill, with a question about the ethics and legality of selling the bones, a box of bones, and Tibetan ritual cups that might have been made from human skulls. They were withdrawn from auction, quote, pending further analysis, unquote, Mr. Hill said in an email. Of course, Lawson's is aware of the laws prohibiting sale of human tissue, hence the withdrawal from sale, he said in a later text message. The items in question were consigned as part of an estate matter, and the family have been advised. The collector was a worldly gentleman with a keen interest in ethnography and indigenous cultures. The vendors, with assistance from Lawson's, will be seeking advice on how best to dispose of the items. Professor David Ranson of Victoria's Institute for Forensic Medicine said that when collections of human bones turn up, they often belong to skeletons once used for teaching medicine. Pencil marks showing where the muscles attached would be one clue. In the 19th and 20th centuries, Western medical students commonly bought complete or partial skeletons exported from India, which banned the trade in 1985. This was absolutely normal. You could go to a medical bookshop and buy a half skeleton, Professor Ranson said. Today that's been almost entirely replaced by plastic replicas. Professor Ranson said human remains should be handed in to the police or a coroner in case they related to a suspicious or unknown death. Dr. Gill, a sociologist researching links between British colonialism and the human body trade, said laws prohibiting the sale of human tissue protected against organ trading, but also ensured dignity for the dead. The management and treatment of the dead is very much about respect of and for the human, she said. Bones shouldn't be displayed in a shop. They shouldn't be a Halloween costume, a curio. In 2013, Melbourne auctioneer Charles Lesky advertised two undocumented skeletons that came from a medical museum. Mr. Leskey devised a plan in which he would sell a photograph of the bones and then gift them to the photograph's buyer to avoid the ban on selling. It's not illegal to own them, he said. In 2016, eBay banned the sale of all human remains except hair. Apart from the box of human bones, Lawson's natural history sale also had advertised two Tibetan skull kapalas. While there were no further descriptions of the objects on the website, kapalas are described by Encyclopaedia Britannica as ritual cups made of human skulls. Another Lawson sale of contemporary and vintage objects last week featured a skull cap and bones. The kapalas and the skull cap were also withdrawn from sale pending further analysis, the manager said. And now, from skeletons, whether or not in the cupboard, let's go to jewels in the crown. And I think one of Sydney's jewels is the Sydney University quadrangle. I'll read you what Wikipedia says. The quadrangle is a prominent building of Sydney sandstone located within the University of Sydney Camperdown campus. Taking over 100 years to complete, the quadrangle was designed and developed by numerous contributors, including Edmund Blackett, James Barnett, and Leslie Wilkinson. The original building included the Great Hall and was constructed between 1855 and 1862. Construction on the quadrangle began in 1854, and it had four sides by 1926, and was completed in the 1960s after several stages of development. Wikipedia tells us that the style of architecture is the Gothic Revival, which may ring a bell if you think of the Houses of Parliament at Westminster. So a visit to Sydney University and the quadrangle is strongly recommended. But if you do go there, there's something else that you should have a look out for, and that's the Chancellor's Committee gift shop. And Jeremy Lee Stanley Travers, who runs the gift shop, has sent me this information about it. The Chancellor's Committee gift shop is located under the clock tower of the quadrangle at the University of Sydney. It sells a variety of university memorabilia, from books to glassware to jewellery to postcards. All the money raised goes back to the university to fund scholarships and contributions to university projects. The shop is open Monday to Friday from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. Further information can be found via the shop's website at sydney.edu.au/ccs/shop. The phone number is 9351 3927. As with us at 2RPH, the Chancellor's Committee is a volunteer-run organisation. That's all we have time for today on the Antiques Radio Show. If you have any feedback or issues you'd like to raise, please telephone 9518 8811 or email info@2rph.org.au. I'm Jolyon Warwick James, and I work in the antiques industry. I have developed this program as a volunteer, unrelated to my business.